I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. David Grand joins me now. He is the author of a gripping and remarkable book, The Lost City of Z, a tale of deadly obsession in the Amazon. It is a New York Times bestseller, and the notices have been universally good. It is a story of Colonel Percy Fawcett, who in 1925 vanished. The British explorer was in search of a mysterious ancient civilization in the jungles of the Amazon. He thought that there was a sort of lost city of Z, or El Dorado, and he sought to prove it. However, he disappeared without a trace. Many have tried to follow in Fawcett's footsteps, and about 100 people have also died trying. Grand sets out first to write a book on Fawcett's fascinating life, which is said to have inspired Arthur Conan Doyle, but also sets out on his own journey. What happens makes for a fascinating book, thus the well-deserved acclaim and book buying. It has also captured the attention of Hollywood, as Brad Pitt has optioned the book and could very well star in a film adaptation of The Lost City of Z, which is published by Doubleday. David Grand is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he's been since 2003. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program in Toronto this morning, David Grand. Good morning, Mr. Grand.
Well, good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Is it Z or Zed? I guess you're in Canada today. Would be Zed.
You know, it's funny. I've been to England and I've been to Canada, and so here we often, people have said the city of Zed, and in the U.S. I'm always saying the city of Z.
Fawcett was British, so I guess it would be Zed.
He probably would have said the city of Zed.
Yeah. You must be gratified by all the wonderful reviews.
Yeah, it's been really nice. You know, it was my first book, and you kind of embark on this journey that ends up consuming so much of your life, and this book, propelled me into places of the world I would never ordinarily go, and so it's been very rewarding that it seems to be finding an audience.
This started as a profile in the magazine.
That's right. It started in the New Yorker. I had done an earlier story for the New Yorker on the death of a leading Conan Doyle scholar, and in the course of that research, I come upon a reference that Fawcett had helped inspire, as you mentioned, Conan Doyle's novel, The Lost World. And I was curious about that. I had plugged Fawcett's name into one of these newspaper databases, and up came all these kind of crazy headlines, like Fawcett disappears into the unknown, another Fawcett search party disappears. And so that's how it kind of began, at least the germ of it, kind of one mystery led to another mystery.
Did you think when you were writing this that you had this sort of book on your hands, a fascinating story and quite possibly a movie?
No, I didn't. Things began incrementally, but it was the first story I had ever worked on where I just had too much information and too many places to go, and that the form that I'd always kind of sat very happily in, which is at the New Yorker, which are these very long, I do very long stories for them, narrative nonfiction, just didn't kind of fit it. I just couldn't do it. I had begun to just collect boxes and thousands of pages of copies of Victorian diaries and letters, and my office was being taken over by maps, and there just wasn't enough space to put all these things. And so the book was kind of just a natural outgrowth of that. But when I began and started on the project, I really had no concept of what I was getting myself into, including the fact I never thought I'd actually go to the jungle.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in just a sec, but one critic that I was reading of the book says that you were obsessed with Fawcett just as he was with Z.
I think that's fair to say. I mean, those words, I never like to think of myself in those terms, which is why I hesitate and I pause, because I hate to say, oh, I was so obsessed, I did this thing, but there was something about the story and the mystery that got under my skin and made me do things that I ordinarily wouldn't do. And when I began it, I started much more in a way that was kind of suited for my paltry physical attributes, and I was going around to libraries and archives around the world, and I had eventually gone to England, and I had tracked down Fawcett's granddaughter, and she led me into her house, and we chatted for a while, and I explained to her my interest. Of course, she said, you don't look much like an explorer, and I said, no, I'm not really. And she said, at one point, she said, well, do you want to know what happened to my grandfather? And I said, well, yes, sure, if at all possible. And she had led me into a back room where she'd had this old trunk, and she'd open up the trunk, and in that old trunk were all these books that were old and disintegrating. They were covered in dust and mud, and I asked her what they were, and she said, well, those are my grandfather's secret diaries and logbooks. And it was at that point when I began to go through those documents and comb them for clues that I found out a lot of new information about where Fawcett had really gone in the jungle, where the city of Zed or Z might be, and that's when I really decided to go head off into the jungle.
And you were the first to have had access to these diaries and logs, right?
That's right. I mean, when it happened, there may have been other people who have perused them. Nothing had ever been published. And the family had kept them private for generations. And the reason being is that the family, well, for many was kind of seen as a mystery. For them was really this kind of colossal tragedy. And so the first generation had just not shared that information with anyone. And it was only with the passing of that generation where the granddaughter was willing to make them available.
I love this line about Fawcett and this journey, that he was armed with little more than a machete, a compass, and almost a divine sense of purpose.
Yeah, that was really Percy. He was really the last of this kind of breed of explorers. He's often classified as a Victorian explorer because he came of age in the Victorian age. A lot of his explorations were actually during the Edwardian period, but he was really the last of this kind of breed who would venture into these blank spots with essentially, yeah, a machete, a compass, and an almost divine sense of purpose. He began exploring the Amazon area in 1906, and the Amazon is about the size of the continental United States, the wilderness area. It's just enormous. And the area back then was really seen as mysterious as the dark side of the moon. One of the most acclaimed geographers at the time said, "What is there? No one knows, at least outsiders." And the area was so unexplored that several of the countries, Peru, Bolivia, and Brazil, they didn't even know where the borders were in the interior, and they needed somebody to come in and map the area. And so Fawcett, that's how he began exploring the Amazon. He was sent in to explore the area, and he began to map thousands of square miles. And these expeditions were pretty extraordinary in their own right. Fawcett would take, you know, about a dozen men. They had almost no protection against the assault of the jungle. You know, even a frog, this Philobates terribilis, has enough toxins in it to kill 100 people. But it was really the little pests that transported everything from malaria to yellow fever to elephantiasis to bone crusher fever that were so deadly. And Fawcett has been had no immunities, and usually half his party would die of disease and starvation.
So where did this purpose stem from? I mean, you mentioned that he'd come of age in the Victorian era. Were people like that always driven to find new places and things of that sort?
Well, the various circumstances during the Victorian age kind of made it, you know, this exploration. It was almost a cult of exploration in the Victorian era. Part of it was the British Empire was expanding outward and making contact with other parts of the world. Also, technology, the steamship was allowing people to go farther, quicker. And then also, just even things, printing presses had improved remarkably, which allowed the transmission of information. So explorers' writings became extremely popular. These books and these penny presses were enormously popular and allowed the dissemination of these expeditions and these trips, which created almost a cult of these explorers. So all these forces were going on during the Victorian era, and Fawcett kind of grew up, you know, worshipping such figures as Burton and Speke and Livingston. And he actually went to the Royal Geographical Society in London. And what's amazing, and I didn't know this until I began researching the book, is that this institution was almost like a finishing school for explorers. And these men would, young men would go there, and they would learn how to survey and map, and they would be given manuals on how to survive in the wilderness. Now, these manuals, their training was extremely primitive. It would tell them, for example, if they were bitten by a poisonous snake, to take gunpowder, pack it into the wound, and ignite it. So there wasn't much, but in any case, they went there, and then they were sent off to all sorts of parts of the world to kind of fill in and map these last blank spaces.
Had he gone elsewhere other than South America?
He had served in the military, and he had served his after his training in the military in Ceylon, or what is today Sri Lanka, and that kind of was his first exposure to kind of the world beyond England, and really ignited his imagination. He did a lot of exploring on the island, got very interested early on in kind of ancient civilizations. He went to a lot of the archaeological sites, which were just being kind of uncovered at that time in Sri Lanka. So all these things exposed and kind of fueled his imagination. He also went to Northern Africa. After he trained at the Royal Geographical Society, he was actually recruited to be a spy. And that was actually very common back then. The British Empire would take surveyors or map makers and use them as spies because it was the perfect cover to send them into these places to nose around. So Fawcett did that, and then he turned his attention fully to the Amazon, and he really spent nearly two decades exploring the region.
1925 is generally the year that he is said to have disappeared. What has been the consensus heretofore on what happened to him?
Well, I would say there probably was no consensus, which is always what has enticed people and made the mystery so alluring. Fawcett headed in 1925. He brought with him only two people, his older son Jack and his son's older son's best friend, Riley Rymel. And the three of them marched into the jungle. Now, they sent out, Fawcett wrote dispatches describing his experience as he went into the jungle. And then he would give them to Indian runners who carried them out of the jungle to one outpost, and they were carried to another outpost. This would take weeks. And then eventually they'd reach a city, and they'd be typed up on telegraph machines, and they'd be kind of blasted around the world in what seemed like a feat of magic. And so that millions of people around the world were following this expedition. And for 5 months, these dispatches emerged out of the jungle, crumpled and stained, and then they ceased. And Fawcett had warned that he might be out of contact for a while, but a year passed, then 2 years, and the fascination and anxieties grew, and all sorts of theories abounded. I mean, Fawcett had always been so indestructible. I mean, his powers of endurance were so legendary that during his day, some colleagues claimed he was immune to death. So it was very hard for people to wrap themselves around the notion that this indestructible explorer could have been destroyed in the jungle. And so there were theories, were they starving? Were they in need of rescue? Had they been killed by Indians? Were they kidnapped by a tribe? Had they perished from disease? So every theory basically abounded. There were theories that he was made a chief of a tribe. I mean, there were, some of them were quite fantastical and wild. There were theories they had decided to abandon civilization because they didn't like it and decided to stay in the jungle. They were too entranced with Z to return. So basically every theory abounded. And for decades, people tried to solve the mystery and find out what happened to them and did this city really exist. And countless explorers began to go in. And just to give you some sense of how compelling this was to people, in 1928, when the first rescue effort, search party, was launched by a man named Diet, tens of thousands of people volunteered from all walks of life to join that expedition. And they continued all the way into the present. In 1996, a large-scale effort led by a Brazilian financier and adventurer set out. He also brought his son with him, and they were kidnapped by a tribe and held in captivity for several days before escaping.
Well, what do you think happened to Fawcett?
Well, one of the more interesting things on my trip was I tried to follow his trail as precisely as possible, and I stayed with several of the tribes that he had stayed with on his trip. And they have oral histories. They don't keep written records, but they have oral histories. It's the way they preserve their past. And to my astonishment, they actually had an oral history about Fawcett. The Kalapalo Indians did. And Fawcett had stayed there with them. They were among the first white men they had ever seen. And they had recorded this kind of strange moment of these bearded, white, strange figures, sickly figures emerging out of the wilderness. And they passed this oral history down for generations. And it really does hold enormous clues to what happened to Fawcett. They described being able to see their party, and the party insisted on moving eastward. And the Kalapalos had warned them not to head in that direction. That's where what they called were the fierce Indians were in that area. And they beseeched Fawcett not to go, and Fawcett insisted on going, and they could see their fire for several days before it was snuffed out. And that oral history in all its entirety, I think, does hold probably the best clues to what did really happen to them.
And there's a tribe that allegedly killed him. You talked to them as well?
Well, the tribe, interestingly enough, this tribe, the Kalapalo Indians, had often been alleged to have killed Fawcett. And when I was with them, they said that was not true. And they then told me this oral history that had amazing details about them. And one of the amazing things about that oral history is it's so precise, it even describes the instrument that Fawcett carried with him, this little flute-like recorder. And the only reason I knew Fawcett carried that instrument was because I had one of his letters home where he told his wife he brought that with him so he wouldn't go mad in the solitude of the jungle.
Now, you talked to one woman who says she remembered him.
Yes.
What did she remember most about him?
Yeah, when I stayed with the Bakary Indians, and the Bakary Indians were one of the first Indians in the Mato Grosso region in this area near where Fawcett disappeared that had been contacted by the Brazilian government. And Fawcett had stayed there in 1925. And this woman, when I got to the settlement, everyone said, oh, you have to meet this one woman. And I went to meet her, and she was the oldest person in the, oldest woman in the individual in the settlement. She didn't know her precise age, but she was about 100 years old, and she'd been a little girl. And she remembered when they came through. She described them staying in the city. She described that kind of element of mystery and that they were about them and that they were kind of given slightly nicer conditions in which to stay in. And for her, it was so interesting because you got to see it from the other point of view, and that was one of the things that really interested me is, you know, the story is often only told from one side, from Fawcett's side or from Europeans or from the family, and here I was getting to see it from many of the inhabitants or the people he would meet. And, you know, for them it was always this kind of, and for her, this kind of inexplicableness. Why did they come? What compelled them to go? We told them not to go in that direction. And so there was kind of a different view of exploration in their expedition.
How did he treat natives wherever he traveled? Was he like other explorers who took a low view of them and regarded them as mere savages?
Yeah. I mean, and savages, that was the terminology for the day. And Fawcett actually bristled at that terminology. I mean, Fawcett grew up in the Victorian age. He was instilled with all the racist attitudes. When you read the manuals he was given on early ethnology, I mean, they would make anyone modern reader today just kind of shiver because they were just so blatantly racist. I mean, you know, to notions about, like, sizes of heads, you know, determining intellect and you know, just notions that are bunk. And Fawcett had been instilled with all these notions. And yet when he went into the jungle, he lived with many of these tribes, and he often treated them with great respect and deference, and he was always struck by the complexity and the richness of their cultures. And so there's this great contradiction in Fawcett where he's kind of always trying to reconcile both what he was taught and then what he actually saw and experienced. And one of the things about Fawcett that is striking is that he refused to let his men fire on the Indians under any circumstances, even if they were being ambushed. And once in kind of mad fashion, he ordered his men to say, "Sing God Save the Queen," and he took off, he dropped his weapon, and he marched forward waving a handkerchief. So for his time period, his approach to the Indians was in many ways much more progressive than many of his colleagues.
How long into starting this book did you decide to go into the jungle yourself?
You know, it took a while. I had never kind of rolled the dice both physically in terms of the risk to my own life, and then also normally with a story you have some sense of what you're going to find. I mean, let's say you're doing a profile about somebody, well, you spend time with them, and if I'm doing a crime story, I kind of know what happened, and I'm just trying to get the documents or what it might be. But this is a story where I really didn't know the end. I had no idea what I was going to uncover. And it was really over a period of many months piecing together clues and going to archives where I eventually felt compelled to go. And then, even then, I didn't really know exactly what I would find. And I was, for me, some of these discoveries, like the oral history or meeting that woman who was probably the last person who's still alive who saw Fawcett and his brother alive, those kind of discoveries along the way made all the hardship worth it.
How long did you spend there?
Well, the trip was about 2 months, and it was about 5 weeks in the you know, more serious wilderness areas, which was plenty long for me.
You didn't enjoy it at all?
I enjoy it. You know, it's interesting. I'm not an outdoorsman, and I know for some people there's probably some element of the outdoors that they relish, you know, that kind of, you know, that sense of kind of, I don't know what it is, what drives people to climb mountains. That's just not part of my DNA. What I did enjoy was meeting many of the indigenous communities and living with them and hearing their stories. And so those experiences to me were kind of wonderful. Things like trekking and hacking through the jungle aren't my thing. So when I was doing that, you know, you know, it's interesting, I suppose, but for me, I was very much more focused on the mechanics of what I was looking for, the objects in my quest. And so I enjoyed the quest. I mean, I relished many elements of it. Going through the wilderness parts, you know, that kind of physical, I don't get some physical satisfaction of that. And in fact, I was lost at one point in the wilderness, and that was really the worst part of my experience.
Did you think you'd die?
You know, I probably never precisely said I'm going to die in those terms, but I was genuinely scared. I mean, to be lost in a wilderness area like that, I didn't have food, I'd been separated from my God, I didn't have water, and it was certainly very terrifying, and it was a moment where I, you know, it's funny, the way I dealt with my fear was I became angry. I was very angry at myself, and I became very angry at Fawcett. I kind of blamed him for everything, and I started started to curse him. I remember cursing him in the jungle, and I was cursing him for me, and I was cursing him for his son, and all these other people who had gone on these mad, quixotic quests, basically dying in his name.
We've heard about the destruction of the Amazon for years. How different does it look from when Fawcett was there?
It's pretty astonishing. And one of the most interesting things was to stand in the very places where Fawcett had. And I try to alternate in the book between the past and the present, between my own quest and Fawcett's life and his quest, to give people some sense of just how the world has changed in a few decades. And early on in the expedition, I set out from the city of Cuiabá in Mato Grosso, heading towards the Xingu area where Fawcett disappeared. Now, the word Mato Grosso, it's a Brazilian state, and it literally means dense forest. But early on in this part of the trip, I had Fawcett's letters with me from his trip and his dispatches, and I'm reading them, and they're describing the intensity of the wilderness and hacking through this, you know, just this complete jungle, and the jungle was so thick that he got separated from his son, and Raleigh, the third companion, was sick. And while I'm reading these letters, I'm looking at them, and there's nothing there. There are no trees. There's no forest. All the wilderness has been cut down and deforested. And, you know, I think of it in American terms, in U.S. terms, I think of it as it struck me like Nebraska, which is, you know, like a plain, just these open plains. But all that was there was these burnt stumps, and this area was being converted and transformed into soybean farms. So in the early stage of my trip, not only was the wilderness different, it no longer existed. I mean, it literally was gone. I mean, and so I had read about deforestation, but I had never quite comprehended it until that experience. Now, the Amazon's an enormous space, and so as we move further north, especially into indigenous areas, the wilderness came back. And one of the interesting things I discovered on my trip, which other people knew, but I just was unaware of, it's actually where the indigenous areas and the areas of the jungle that remain under indigenous control, those areas, the jungle, are still extremely well preserved. And one of the amazing things, one of the things that Fawcett remarked on, was how many of the indigenous communities had kind of ingeniously adapted to their environment. And for them, it really wasn't a green hell. They had adapted to their environment. They manipulated their environment. They found ways to get food in their environment, how to sustain populations in their environment. But they also preserved the jungle, and they didn't destroy it.
People should pick up the book to see, to read about your meeting with Michael Heckenberger, from the archaeologist from the University of Florida, and the conclusions that you came to. But the last question I'll ask you, David, is how involved are you with the movie?
I pretty much leave it in their hands. I tend to kind of think that they're far more capable than I, and I'm excited about it. And Brad Pitt has optioned it, and they've hired this really wonderfully talented American screenwriter and director, a man named James Gray, and he just directed the movie Two Lovers and wrote it, which I just saw recently, and it's quite amazing. And this is a very different setting for him, but I have great faith in him. So he calls me occasionally to ask me research questions, and I'm always happy to help them, but I try to keep the two things pretty separately.
Well, David, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about it. Congratulations and continued good luck with the book.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
The book is called The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon. DavidGran.com is his website. It's published by Doubleday. The New Yorker's David Gran on the line. I'm Joseph Plana.